Some Americans are turning their life stories into art. Scrapbooking has become a noun and big business. Craft stores across the nation feature the latest in thematic page-making and decorating accessories to make memory books on every conceivable topic. But Americans kept scrapbooks of amazing beauty and complexity long before they had any commercial help. That's what Jessica Helfand found when she researched her gorgeous new book called Scrapbooks in American History. She says people just got on with telling the story they wanted to tell.
People very often didn't start at the beginning and go to the end. It's in and out, and they go backwards and forwards and rip things out and change their mind and add different color inks. And so if you're sort of approaching it in an analytical, almost forensic way, you really can't just assume to start at the beginning and to go to the end tells the story. There are many internal narratives that sort of feed through the general arc of the major story, and it's sort of up to the person looking at the scrapbook to try to dissect and figure out, in fact, what was going on, sometimes over many, many years.
They are stories, but I gather also from looking through the variety in your book that sometimes these stories aren't obvious. In some cases, you're not even sure where the real story is.
It's an excellent point, I think, because certainly in today's world, all of us tend to move very quickly through any kind of way that we process information. And these things really demand that you slow down and listen and look and don't assume. And I found also it was quite humbling to me that after looking at some 200 scrapbooks, the 201st didn't come to me any more swiftly as a result of that trajectory. I had to still begin slowly. And in some cases, I had to go offline and look at the ancestral records of the person or the town in which they lived or the time in which they lived to try to kind of patch together this story that might not be so declarative the way you would perhaps in a diary write very much first person. These things are much more kind of anecdotal and piecemeal, as you say.
Were you surprised as you began to look at all the different scrapbooks? Were you surprised by how many and how varied they were?
I was indeed, and I had to limit myself. I had to limit myself to American scrapbooks. I limited myself to a period, about 1870 to about 1945. I felt that once television entered the living room, the imagination that people had visually to create things that put pictures and words together was somewhat, supplanted by the fact that there was a television bringing the outside world in. And so while people continued to make scrapbooks in the 50s and 60s and 70s, they tend to be a little bit more monotonous in terms of their content. Lots of Route 66 maps and motel postcards and a kind of flattening out of the kinds of materials I'd seen earlier. I mean, some of the things I found, for example, in the 1910s and 20s, you know, the things during women's suffrage, for example, before women could vote, how women expressed their concern about the war, the way people processed World War I versus the way they processed World War II when women could vote and could volunteer and could be part of an effort that was much more inclusive. The fact that there was no Scotch tape before 1929. And so to glue something in a book required quite a bit of imagination. All of these things were interesting to me because they really helped me understand how a composite visual picture of a life could actually be made. And it wasn't, there were no pre-existing commercially available supplies such as there are today. Not to denigrate these supplies, because I think some of them are marvelous and they're archival, and some of the reproduction ephemera, as much as it sounds like an oxymoron, really will last into the next century. But I find that there is such an emphasis on buying store-bought things to tell a story that is your own that it creates a kind of meaningless visual grammar. And I wrote this book in part to tell this backstory, but also to look at this very, I think, vivid and genuine form of visual biography that I think in many ways is quintessentially American.
This book is filled with photographs of scrapbooks from many periods in time. I'm curious, I guess, as to what it was about 1870. Was that simply the oldest American scrapbook that you found?
No, there are many older ones. Thomas Jefferson kept scrapbooks. And if you go back to commonplace books and extra illustrated books and Grangerite books, which I talk about briefly in my introduction, they tend to be interesting depending on the person who was writing them, of course. But what happens, I think, in any kind of visual history is that you make what you can make based on the tools available to you at any time. And I didn't want to organize the book chronologically because then I would just be talking about black and white printing giving way to color printing. And I wanted to organize it around bigger ideas that had to do with the people who kept these books and why they chose to do so. But I think that one thing that I found around 1870 is when Mark Twain patented a self-pasting scrapbook. And I love this for two reasons. One, obviously, that We think of scrapbooking as a gendered activity, and this was a man, a prolific writer, who it is said, although it may be apocryphal, that he made more money from the self-pasting patent than he did from all of his fiction combined. The second thing was that when I was sitting at the Beinecke researching this, I actually found the patent application in which he wrote this very long piece of prose that declared that this was really actually a good thing for the church, because if you were a scrapbook enthusiast, come Sunday morning, you could never find your paste, and you would walk around the house swearing. And so if blasphemy wanted to be put under control, it would be really good to create this thing that and sure enough, it was, you know, you put water on it, and it was self-pasting. But he had this rationale that was based on, you know, reducing blasphemy in the home. So I thought that was kind of a nice, you know, energizing way to start the book. And then I was very interested in what was going on at the turn of the century. And the fact that, you know, you look at scrapbooks from 1900, and scrapbooks from 1920, and the things people are doing in 1920 are much more dramatic visually. People are cutting off heads, decapitating arms and legs, combining words and pictures in a much more kind of reckless abandon, and a much more adventurous spirit. And these are people who had no idea what was going on in Europe, but in Dada and the salons across Europe. And so it was interesting to me to look and see if there was actually some kind of modernist tendency as time wore on between the wars, in which people used their scrapbooks to try to express what they were feeling, what was going on around them, and who they were.
You do have to read each story several times, don't you? Because it tells a different story depending on how you look at it. But when you start to look at the story, it gives you a sense of who the person was that you probably couldn't get from a journal entry.
I think that's true. And I think also there's a subtlety to the way people saved things, what they wrote, what they didn't write. I think that omission is actually extremely important, or annotation, crossing someone's name out. I had a scrapbook from a woman who was married in the 60s who wrote all her ambitions on the front page, and the bottom one was housewife. And then she goes in to include all the photographs of her friends and went back later in a more mature handwriting and wrote who was divorced, who ran off with whom, who did what. And you can see that even though she may not have been happy being that housewife, she was going to put cement on the page, those pictures and that annotation, to say that she was still married and she still had children and she still had a house, and so she was okay. In another case, a woman who was a very young woman when the Lindbergh baby was kidnapped saves a picture of the child's baby booties on one side, and on the other side, in a very awkward handwriting, draws her family tree and the ages of her baby brothers at her age. And you can see her literally working out how she would deal with such a tragedy were it to have happened in her own family. And so sometimes you have playful juxtapositions, like a picture of Rudy Valentino next to a prayer card, or a laundry list next to a college diploma, or a gum wrapper next to, you know, a wedding bouquet. And other times you have things where you really can see this very palpable emotional need to work things out on paper by making a curious little family tree next to a picture of the Lindbergh baby.
These are such personal documents that you'd think that they would be treasured family possessions. But I gather even in your own family, you were surprised to discover a scrapbook that you should have had that was up in somebody's attic.
My grandmother's scrapbook was found by a cousin of mine after she died, and we just loved it because it had all these pictures of her and our grandfather frolicking with their friends in 1916, 17, 18. And, you know, we remember them as very serious people and, you know, sort of the head of the family. And the idea that, you know, she had a dance card filled with names that weren't my grandfather was kind of fun. And we wondered, you know, did she not show it to us on purpose? Did she not know that it was there? It wasn't one of the more beautiful scrapbooks I found, but of course it was poignant to me. And you're absolutely right. You can't believe some of these scrapbooks that they would secede from the families that belong to them. And in some cases, I have actually traced the families and I'm giving the scrapbooks back. And that's been a very interesting exercise. I don't think I thought when I began this project that I would be doing that. But in some cases, it's been quite a rewarding thing to take it full circle.
We've talked about these almost exclusively as though they were put together by women. But in fact, that's not the case. One of them that I found fascinating was, I think his name is Francis Johnson, Pop Johnson.
Pop Johnson. Pop Johnson was from Waterbury, Connecticut, and he worked in a tool and die manufacturing plant, and he never really left Waterbury, Connecticut, except to go to war. And his scrapbook is filled with his dog tags and his fingerprints and his ration cards and wonderful things, sad things, friends that he lost, taped in obituaries from young men who served with him, very crudely drawn maps where he traces in crayon where he goes overseas. And we actually tracked some of his family members down. They all want the scrapbook. There's rather a bidding war going on in his family at the moment. But it was very, very touching because he married and later divorced. He had no children. Interestingly, many of the scrapbooks that I'm finding where I have traced the families, it's because there were no children. And I don't think that I put that together until just now in describing this to you. And it's not that any of these families are any more important than any other. They were rich, poor, East Coast, West Coast, all sorts of regions all across the United States. But I think what's so interesting when you start to really deconstruct them is how many similarities there were. I mean, everybody was concerned about things during the Depression or worried about things during the war or happy when the war was over. I mean, there were certain universal symptoms that revealed themselves in the pages of these scrapbooks. People say things about Christmas and New Year's and birthdays and weddings. I mean, there's certain episodic details that every family goes through. But interstitially between those details is where the real stories happen. And that's what took so long and was really so much fun to try to excavate.
Jessica Helfand is the author of Scrapbooks, An American History.